Hello, this is Kara Dahl Russell. You've probably heard by now on our station that on September 29th at 7:30 p.m. in Holloway Hall Auditorium, we will have a very special musical guest. After a fundraising dinner for the Salisbury Symphony Orchestra, there will be a recital by internationally renowned violist Roberto Diaz, and I'm fortunate to have him on the phone with me now. Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. Why don't you start by telling me a little bit about your musical background?
Well, actually, I come from a musical family. There's four of us kids, I suppose you'd say, and we're all musically trained. Three of us became professional musicians. We had music at the house from as far back as we can remember, and it's been a wonderful life in music for all of us.
So your parents were musicians?
That is correct. My mother was a pianist, and my father is also a violist, actually.
That might answer my next question. A lot of people start with the violin and move to the viola. How did you end up paired with the viola?
Well, actually, just like that, because when I was growing up in Chile, actually, there were no young violists. The reason for that was very simple. Actually, there were no youth orchestras existing at that time. What's been interesting to see is that nowadays, my understanding is that there are over 1,200 youth orchestras in Chile alone. And, you know, traveling in South America, you really can see that this type of training has become an incredibly important part of young people's lives more recently, which is a great thing. And so you have young viola players now because you have orchestras. But when I was growing up, everybody studied the violin or the cello or the piano, basically.
The viola can be, I think, a bit of a misunderstood instrument. Even on the back of the CD that we've been listening to here on our station, the William Primrose transcriptions, you called it, or someone on the back of the CD, it says it's the dull dog of the string family.
Oh, that's what Primrose was quoted as saying at one point, apparently.
Well, you've clearly been a great ambassador for it. What do you think are some common misconceptions about the viola?
Well, I think that the biggest misconception really comes from the fact that many people have yet to hear the viola as a solo instrument. I mean, they don't hear the viola usually played in front of an orchestra or to hear a viola recital. I mean, they're both considerably more rare or unusual than, say, hearing the Tchaikovsky violin concerto or the Dvorak cello concerto or a piano concerto.
Yes.
But what's nice about that is that when people finally do get to hear the viola, they really do get attracted to it. And it's very funny because if you ask 10 viola players, you know, why do you play the instrument? They'll tell you, well, it's the sound, is the attractiveness of the sound. And, you know, the range of the viola is really much closer to the range of the human voice than, say, that of the violin or the cello.
Especially as now a teacher at the Curtis Institute, do you feel that the repertoire for the viola still needs great improvement, that it needs to be expanded greatly?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly in the 20th century, as the viola kind of grew up into a solo instrument, in the 19th century and earlier even, there were pieces for viola and orchestra, but very, very few, or not particularly good pieces. What we did see in the 20th century was all of a sudden certain personalities on the viola that really kind of brought the instrument into the forefront. We have Hindemith in Germany, Lionel Tertis in the UK, and then of course there was William Primrose, which was sort of the big first big superstar of the viola. And then, you know, there have been many, you know, really fantastic, fabulous, very virtuoso-like viola players that are coming up even now. And, you know, when you have people that play this way, then the music follows them. So, you know, I could spend the rest of my life trying to learn the music that has already been written for the viola, and I don't think I'll make it, you know, to do everything. But I can tell you that pieces are being written for the viola all the time, which is wonderful.
It was so nice to listen to the Primrose transcriptions from those very romantic, lush pieces that really show off the rich voice of the viola.
Yeah.
I like to ask artists of your caliber, and you do indeed have a great background, having worked with conductors such as Roberto Abbado, Riccardo Chailly, Charles Dutoit, Michael Tilson Thomas. I'd like to ask people, as you kind of went through your career from playing as a youngster to going through the steps of your career, what about the life of a musician would be something that you couldn't have even thought to ask about that sort of brought you up short in terms of the realities of the life of a musician?
Well, I think that one of the things that as a youngster one never really thinks about is the fact that this is a forever learning process. You know, you never really get there. That can be a sense of frustration for some, but it's also like an incredible life's experience, you know. And when you mention some of these conductors and some of these composers that we have the opportunity to work with, it's a sense of discovery every time you work with one of these people, because they'll come at something that you've done a certain way for many years from a completely different place, and they bring their experiences to it. It's really an amazing thing because there's a sense of discovery that is never ending. And, you know, that's what makes it so that when you go and you play a recital tour, every concert is going to be completely different. And that's a wonderful thing. You know, you walk out on stage and you say, well, let's see how this is going to be tonight. I think that the audiences go to concerts because there is that sense of discovery. When you go to a concert hall to hear a performance, there's a certain sense of excitement about the fact that this music is being made right then and there. And honestly, is what keeps us artists curious. You'll never play it the same way that you did last time with someone else, which is also, I think, a great thing.
It's beautiful, very poetic way of looking at performance. How long have you been teaching at the Curtis Institute now?
You know, I started teaching here, I think, in 2000, when I was a member of the Philadelphia Orchestra. It was around the year 2000 that I started teaching viola at Curtis.
And did you always think that teaching would be part of what you did, or did you come to that later?
You know, I've been teaching for a really long time. My first job was in 1984-85 season. I started in the Minnesota Orchestra before going to the Boston Symphony, and I started teaching people pretty much right away. And then when I was in Boston, I started teaching at Boston Conservatory, and I was doing a little coaching at Tanglewood. And then when I went to the National Symphony, I was teaching at the University of Maryland, and then I started teaching at Peabody, and I've been teaching at Curtis for a number of years now. So it's always been part of what I do, and it's very interesting because I think you learn more from teaching than you do from practicing. It's very interesting. You know, you hear a student play something a certain way, and you think to yourself, why didn't I think of that? And then at the same time, it's really, especially teaching at a place like Curtis, of course, it's a tremendous privilege because the level of ability and talent of these students is unlike anywhere else almost. It is fun to talk about with them. One of my wonderful opportunities that I've had is to play the Penderecki Viola Concerto a number of times with Penderecki actually conducting. I just did it a couple of weeks ago in Brazil. And it's interesting for me that every time I play the piece with him, he wants to do it differently. You know, I remember one time we played it in Portugal. We had just played it in Finland together. And so when we got to Portugal, a couple of weeks after the Finland concerts, I did something a certain way. And he stopped in the rehearsal and he said, why are you playing that like that? And I said, well, maestro, because you asked me to. And he was like, oh, that was a terrible idea. Don't do that. Please don't ever do that again. Even if I ask you, don't do it. You know? And so it was very funny. In Brazil, 2 or 3 weeks ago, the same thing happened. He was like, why are you doing that like that? And I said, well, maestro, I wrote it down in my part. It has your initials next to it. He's like, oh, no. Oh, no. Don't listen to me. He said, you know, you have better sense than that. So it's very interesting to see how even a composer can have his own music sort of evolve from performance to performance.
The challenge of working with a living composer.
Yeah, and it's also a wonderful thing, you know, because when I teach the Penderecki Concerto, I can say, look, All I can tell you is that the last time I played it with him, this is what he wanted.
As you said, the Curtis Institute has a rare place among international music schools. We hear that students are invited to come to the school. As a teacher, are you also invited or do you apply?
You don't really apply. We really have a very unique process. It's more, especially since I'm out there playing a lot, it's usually people that I meet, conversations that happen, and people express viewpoints or certain experiences that they've had. And if I feel like this is something that would be really interesting to have at the school, either as a permanent presence or sometimes bring people in for master classes or a residency, then we do that a lot. And sometimes, a master class turns into a residency, turns into a couple of more residencies, and eventually you never know where that can lead.
With both your position at the school and then also as a working performer, I know our listeners and many symphony listeners express consternation at the so-called state of classical music, the atonal, chaotic, repetitive works, and crossover works. Where do you think classical music is going?
Well, I try to be a little bit more optimistic about just the state of affairs. I think that, classicals implies something, the classics,
Right.
from the past. And actually, it's art, and art has to evolve, and it has to change, and it reflects, our values in our society. And I think that, music, like art, like poetry, like literature, like any discipline in the arts, there are certain parallels. And so, there are certainly folks that would prefer, more classical style music. They like Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms, and then you start getting into Bartok, and they say, "Look, that's about as far as I would be comfortable with."
Yes.
And but I think that, it's our, I say this to my students a lot, especially as viola players. Look, you're going to go out somewhere and you're going to play the Bartok concerto. To you, the Bartok concerto is an old piece, written in 1944 or 45. I said, but you have to understand that when you go play it, 99.9% of the audience has never heard this piece before. So to them, it is a world premiere. And with that comes a certain responsibility. Can you make it so that the performance is clear and is understandable enough that somebody hearing this for the first time will totally understand what it is that you're doing? And so I think it's our responsibility as performers, not just as viola players, but as musicians, to try to bring the audience along. And it's the explanation of it and the purpose of it that needs to be clear, along with the appreciation for it. And that said, there has been great music and there has been terrible music and everything in between, written from the very beginning of written music. Great pieces tend to survive, and the ones that are not that good tend to go into obscurity.
And
And
there's a pendulum swing. Do you think the pendulum is swinging back towards melody yet?
At the beginning of the 20th century, there was clearly a movement that said it doesn't matter if they don't understand it, we don't write it for them anyway.
Yes.
Even Beethoven said so. And so it's like, who cares about the audience? Well, now people are sort of thinking, like, actually, I would rather that they hear it, and I would even prefer that they like it.
Yes.
And so the challenge there is, how do you push into new places and push the boundaries and still make it so that you can write music that has some level of connection to people?
Well, certainly the CD that we've been listening to, your Naxos 557391, the transcription of William Primrose, his viola transcriptions by multiple composers, certainly is extremely accessible, and we've been sampling that through the past few weeks. And you said you have a new CD out now?
The one that we released also on Naxos after the Primrose record is the Sonatas by Brahms. What was interesting about that record was that when Naxos asked me to record the Brahms sonatas, I basically said to them that I would be happy to do it because there's two sonatas that are known as the viola sonatas. They're originally for clarinet and then adapted for viola. I told Naxos that I would be happy to do it if we could find something to record along with these two viola sonatas that made it so that it was not just another recording of the Brahms viola sonatas, which there are dozens of. And so they said, well, let's find something. And I have to say, one of my favorite Brahms pieces of all time is the first violin sonata. Apparently, it was one of Brahms's favorite pieces of his, actually. It's an incredibly, incredibly moving, beautiful piece. It's almost like three slow movements. Brahms himself, he did a transcription of it for cello and piano. And so what happened is that a colleague of mine, Csaba Erdélyi, took the violin version and the cello version and kind of melted them together into a version for viola and piano. For me, the fact that this is one of my all-time favorite pieces, you know, one of those sort of desert island pieces.
Yes.
The fact that all of a sudden it existed in a version for viola and piano, then I said to Naxos, what about if we do this? And they said, great, let's do it.
And congratulations on the nomination for a Grammy Award for William Primrose CD. Thank you so much for your time. We've been very fortunate to be speaking with Roberto Diaz, whom we will be fortunate to be able to see and hear right here in Salisbury, Maryland, on September 29th at the Salisbury University Holloway Hall Auditorium. After a fundraising dinner for the Salisbury Symphony Orchestra, he will perform at 7:30. Who will be accompanying you that night?
Gloria Chien, a fabulous pianist.
And what are some highlights from that program that we can expect?
You know, I think it's a really interesting program. We are starting out with a group of Spanish folk songs. And my father being Spanish, my father actually did this transcription for viola and piano. And then we do the last Brahms sonata, Opus 120 number 2. And after intermission, we do a big Bloch suite for viola and piano from 1919. And it's a wonderful piece, actually, very exciting piece. It has a wonderful piano part, a big cadenza in the middle of the piece for the piano, and it's a lot of, and it's very tuneful. I mean, really a beautiful piece. So
yes,
we're very much looking forward.
As are we. Thank you again for taking time to talk with me.
Absolutely.